Welcome to ASA Pod, the African Studies Association podcast from the 61st Annual Meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, an initiative brought to you by ASA and Matrix Digital Media Lab at Michigan State University. I'm Catherine Mara, and my guest host for today is Karina Ray, an Associate Professor of African and African American Studies at Brandeis University.
Greetings again. My name is Karina Ray from Brandeis University, and I'm here to host a second podcast related to the Ruptures Roundtable. Today we have Okosua Adamako Ampofo from the University of Ghana, Sandra Green from Cornell University, Alan Isaacman from University of Minnesota, and Adrian Resnick, a writer. And today I want to pose a common question and just take a round of responses. So in Sandra Green's 1999 presidential lecture published in the ASR, she observed that, quote, at the heart of the events that shook the 1969 annual meeting of the association in Montreal was the question of who within African studies had the power to define the content of and new directions for the field. Who defined its scholarly standards and who did those who had this power use their positions to include and exclude, to limit and direct the activities of individual scholars and the association, end quote. During tomorrow's Ruptures Roundtable, we'll have ample time to discuss the past that this observation points us to, which I am sure Jean's lecture tonight will also return to. What I would like to do in our podcast today is to discuss where we are today in relation to the question of where power lies in African studies. Does the picture look different? If so, are those differences substantial or merely cosmetic? Are there multiple centers of power, and where do the disciplines fit into this picture? In other words, has change been uneven across the disciplines, and if so, are there reasons for this? Given that we have the disciplines of history, political science, and sociology, as well as the interdisciplines of African studies and women's gender and sexuality studies represented here today, I would invite each of you to bring the specificity of your disciplinary affiliations into the conversation. And for Adrian, who left academia after Montreal, I wonder what you would say about how all of this looks from outside of the academy altogether. So whoever would like to go first. Sandra?
So your question was, how have things changed?
Or if they have, I'm just curious what your diagnosis of the field is today. We're talking a lot about the history, and I just wonder what you think about from your sort of position as a historian in a history department and your knowledge of the field of African history. Have things changed since 1969?
I wasn't in the field in 1969.
Right.
So, but what I have been told about it, of which I experienced some of the remnants of it, was that there were a few white guys who basically controlled the field, determined who was going to be able to get into graduate programs, how well they were going to do, and then had a very clear sense of themselves that if they could call somebody, another institution, and in order to talk about a job opening, that they were confident that they could place their student in that position. So it was a very closed, tight little group. I think the people who were actually formed during that particular period and more active in that period will be able to say a lot more than I am able to, but that's my sense of it. Today, I would say that the centers of power are still there, but they are more dispersed. So you have certain schools, certain universities that produce historians, and they have the resources, et cetera, to do that. But it's much more dispersed than what it used to be.
Alan?
I was there at that time. I was a graduate student, and what Sandra described is quite accurate, except even though it was an old boys' network, it also included Gwendolyn Carter at Northwestern. So you had three or four centers, and these were the presumed centers of excellence. All at major, what they define as major research institutions, all with funding from Ford and Carnegie and Rockefeller, and it was controlled by a handful of people, William O. Brown, Philip Curtin, Gwendolyn Carter, Herskovitz, who's Jean Melville Herskovitz, who Jean is going to talk about. And they literally, it was their domain. They not only colonized the intellectual production of ideas about Africa, but as Sandra suggested, determined who got fellowships and what jobs individuals got or didn't get if they were politically active or intellectually engaged. And they had a very specific intellectual and very narrow intellectual agenda about great men in history, a century. That's changed dramatically today in so many ways in terms of the diffusion of power and influence. The role of African scholars is finally being recognized, although it's an ongoing fight even to this day. One of the biggest challenges, that one of the biggest legacies, is the notion that Western scholars and North American scholars and British scholars do the theorizing, and African scholars do the field work, the empirical work. So we have legacies that continue to this day, but the role of the association, the role of association is different in that we have many more Africans and African Americans involved, many more women involved. It's less anti-democratic than it was, and there's much more, as a result of that diversity, there's much more interesting scholarship that's being produced.
Thank you.
Oswald? Interesting history. 1963, I won't say where I was. But when I joined the ASA in either 94 or 95, I'm not sure, I didn't know any of this history. And when I later discovered it, I was like, whoa, you know, why am I even here? But, you know, coming from sitting in Africa and sitting in Ghana, it was a different space. And of course, you relate to a history that you're hearing through second and third parties differently. But being at the Institute of African Studies, of course, we knew about, you know, this imbalance of power. And when Kwame Nkrumah set up the Institute, he, in the African Genius speech, he specifically tells us to unpack that and to undo that and to make sure that we're doing African studies the way, as, you know, at least he conceived it, African studies should be done. So the whole power thing worked in two ways. One, the way that Isaac has just said, that, you know, we do the field work, right? And the theory is being done somewhere else, and we've got to publish in North American and European journals, and what we do is of a lesser value. But in a way, I think that because that era we didn't have access to a lot of these journals, we kind of escaped knowing what was going on and could, in our own space, do what we were, you know, what we needed to do. So people were doing, people just carried on in their work and cited each other, and you'd get, somebody would go to Dar and come back with something. Somebody would go to Nairobi, come back with something, or go to a meeting. So, you know, in a sense, we were a bit oblivious to that dynamic, which in a way protected us. I think that with the coming of the structural adjustment in the 90s, when we suddenly realized, okay, we're supposed, quote unquote, to be in this space, in this power dynamic structure where we are the people at the bottom of the rung, then people began to feel kind of antsy and, okay, what do we do now? How do we get to also be top professors in the profession and so on? But you asked a question, and I didn't, let me see if I wrote it down. You structured it in a certain way. You said diagnosis of the field. And two things I wanted to say is, one is that young people today, many of them don't care about this power dynamic. They are doing their African studies in their own spaces. The popular culture, the people doing their music, the hip life and hip hop artists who are circulating their music across the continent and with the diaspora. And it's like, okay, you guys can be in the academy and talk your big English, and we don't care. We're going to transmit our knowledge via Twitter and Instagram. So in a way, some of us are becoming irrelevant in the academy, in a sense, because you don't necessarily need that piece of paper or to have been in a space of higher education in order to do your African studies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. I mean, I guess maybe the one follow-up question I would have is to try to think about why the formation of the African Studies Association of Africa. I mean, it seems like an obvious thing, right? But I'm wondering about the sort of like the dynamic between ASA and ASAA, and whether or not there was a kind of sense that even as the presence of scholars based in Africa has expanded within ASA over the years, that there's a way in which the association still does not kind of, it hasn't fully sort of embraced the scale of African studies and isn't, and what I think I'd like for you to maybe talk a little bit about is how you see ASAA sort of coming in and doing a work that maybe the ASA can't do, for instance.
I guess, I mean, when we formed the ASA, a couple of people who'd been talking about these things for a long time, you know, it's like we need a professional home, for one thing, and there are professional issues that concern us on the continent that only we can fix. So issues of tenure and do you have to publish in these journals in order to get promoted? I mean, we have to do that work ourselves to demand support for our journals. We have to do that work together. So that's one. Also, as a space for us to know each other's work, because we cite people from everywhere else but each other, because our journals don't have the same circulation and so on. So it's a space where we can know what we do. So when I'm doing my course outline, it's got Africans from the continent and not just Africans and Africanists from other places. And of course, then there are the practical issues. I mean, ASA is a home for Africanists, but it's not a home for all Africanists. One, you can't afford to come here if you don't have the funding. And two, you just might not get a visa, and that's getting worse.
Right.
So if we want to be together to, you know, to do our Africanist thing, we need our space. And I guess one of the reasons that it's taken so long, I mean, in the 60s, people tried, and, you know, there are conferences that happened, but somehow things didn't take off, and, of course, all the military years. But it's also because in our own academic spaces, people have said, but we're all Africans and Africanists, and we do African studies, so why do you need this ghetto? And it's a battle we have constant. It's like once you have an African university or a university in Africa, then everyone is doing African studies. But of course we know that they are not. And
right,
so we need
right.
that space, you know, to make that happen.
Yeah. Adrian.
Yes, ma'am.
So from the outside, what? Because you've remained engaged in different ways in both African studies, but also the carrying your work in economics into the continent and elsewhere. So, you know, I wonder what this looks like to you. When we last spoke, you know, you sort of said that you were kind of shocked that these issues still animate the politics of the association, so.
That's the petty bourgeois intellectual in me. I'm always expect what I know is not going to happen. I think, well, why does this still happen? Or why didn't that happen? And so there's something in me that's naive and unformed. But I see things still through political eyes. And I still think one of the greatest contributions to intellectual world in history is dialectical historical materialism. I think it still informs about my house, about the neighborhood, whatever I'm looking at. So I see what I'm hearing, and I would look at the academy as in terms of class, in class terms. Mm-hmm. And I hear that at this table, frankly, mm-hmm. that this is a class issue. So, okay, judge not. But I've cast my efforts with Africans, ordinary Africans, when I worked and when I was doing that. I wanted my work to be in the interests of ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I had to focus on the problems of ordinary people. And I had no problem in seeing the academy as an instrument for doing that, every place, especially in Africa. It isn't, but I think it ought to be. I think research and education. I mean, the Africanists of all people should be revolutionizing the communication process in their own countries. And the economists shouldn't. It's such an objectification to go and look and to trap and write all these things down. This isn't ancient Greece. I just don't think it holds. You can make a case for it, a political case for objectifying Africa as the Academy does. Africa is so desperately in need of a thousand different things. What? Ask them. They'll tell you. And I just came from the Walter Rodney lecture, and I've worked with Walter in Dar es Salaam. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he used to do is he never hung out with the academics. He always went down into the villages, mm-hmm. and hung out with people. He wasn't even writing about the Tanzanian society or politics, but that's where he knew the reality was. I think that's where we belong. I think you can be a political scientist and an economist and an anthropologist and so forth and so on, really being with people and doing something for them and asking them, letting them tell you what they need. So it's very judgmental. I can hear it in my own voice, and I would find me very obnoxious if I were the three of you. Sorry, that's what I think.
Alan,
yes. So, yeah, I just want to pick up on one point, one of the legacies that continues today. As a North American white Africanist who has spent a great deal of time in Mozambique and in Southern Africa, one of the things that I know is that we are impoverished. We, the Africanist community in North America, the global North, are impoverished because we know so little about what our colleagues in Africa are doing, because a political economy of knowledge production places Western journals, good privileges Western journals and Western research, and we have no idea about so many of the interesting debates and ideas that are taking place and circulate locally, nationally, and regionally in Africa. And so we living in our own very pristine world, and our research and the research of our graduate students is diminished because we're not really, we don't yet have a really global Africanist community that speaks to each other, not from positions of power and hierarchy, because the power and hierarchy clearly lie with the West, or with North American scholars, but we pay a very heavy price for our privilege and power.
I want to take up on something that on what you just said. The Ghanaian system, you have the tenure systems, you have a lecturer, senior lecturer, associate professor, full professor. So you have two steps before you're tenured. And when I was coming up for, in this case, senior research fellow and not senior lecturer, and the reviews come back to you after, okay, if you're successful, the reviews come back to you. And I remember one of the reviewers saying about one of my papers that, you know, this was great paper, amazing paper, and they were... They wished that I had published it in a more highfalutin journal. But the reviewer also said, and that made me very happy, that because of the journal that I did publish it this in, they felt that there were way more students on the continent, mm-hmm. who would have access to that. I'm like, yeah, but that's the point, because
right.
This is, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not, I want people everywhere to read my work. I would like it to be used in academies, you know, in North America and in Europe. But I'm more interested that students on the continent will read the work, because that, you know, that's, for me, that's my first constituency.
Go ahead, Sandra. Yeah,
I want to add on to that, that there was a lot of hope that came with digitization, internet, websites, mm-hmm. and et cetera, but that in fact it would facilitate this flow of information insofar as people have limited resources to move from one place to another so that they can know what's going on, et cetera. The sad part about this promise, which has never come to fruition, is that the publishing industry has become a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And so journals, you know, you have companies that buy up a lot of journals, mm-hmm. and then they charge an outrageous amount. They bundle a lot of things that you might not necessarily want. And then no one can afford them. except some of the more wealthy libraries, and even the more wealthy libraries are finding it very difficult. So your point that people have now begun to take to Twitter and other kinds of forms of information dissemination is really an important kind of underground effort to get knowledge and communication going, because there's always this tendency, this capitalist tendency, to gain control, dominate, and profit from it.
And we will just photocopy and send it to 200 people, and who's going to come and sue us?
That's it.
I actually think that that is a brilliant note to end on. Thank you all for this wonderful conversation, and now off to Gene Allman's presidential lecture.
Great.
Thank you.
The African Studies Association, in collaboration with Matrix Digital Media Lab at Michigan State University, recorded a series of interviews at the 61st annual meeting of the ASA to immortalize the conversations that take place at and around the annual meeting, and to prioritize the voices of both junior and senior Africanist scholars as they consider topics pertinent to energies, power, creativity, and Afro futures.